Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 8, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, a litigation update on the Dodd-Frank Act lawsuit. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. All expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, please note that the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Finally, our call today, the topic is active litigation, and as such, our experts might be somewhat circumspect in some of the responses to your questions. We have two experts on our call today. Gregory Jacob is a partner at O'Melveny here in Washington, D.C., and a member there of the Financial Services and Labor and Employment Practices. Adam White is counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates, a boutique regulatory law firm in Washington, D.C., where he works on a variety of matters involving regulatory litigation and strategy. And both, as always, of their resumes have been provided to you on our website and also in the notices you received of this call, so I've made my introductions brief. They've got a lot more accomplishments than I've listed here. We're going to hear opening remarks first from Adam White, then from Greg Jacobs, and then again from Adam White for a total of about 20 minutes. So we should be getting to your questions in about 20 minutes or so from now. With that, Mr. White, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. When we had a call about the lawsuit, a telephone about the lawsuit last summer or early last fall, we had not yet amended the complaint, and so the case was brought by three private plaintiffs, West Texas Community Bank, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and the 60-plus Association, brought against federal defendants challenging the Dodd-Frank's creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and President Obama's appointment of Richard Cordray to lead the CFPB, an appointment without Senate advice and consent. Not long after that teleforum, we amended the complaint in a couple of important ways. We expanded the claims in the case to now challenge not just the CFPB and the FSOC, but also the so-called Orderly Liquidation Authority, a provision in Dodd-Frank that authorizes the Treasury Secretary and the FDIC to unilaterally liquidate financial companies, non-bank financial companies, outside of the usual rules of bankruptcy. We brought claims the claims were that specifically that the Orderly Liquidation Authority violates the Constitution's separation of powers, violates due process, and it violates the Constitution's requirement that the bankruptcy laws be uniform. In addition to expanding the complaints, the case also added some new plaintiffs, specifically the state of Oklahoma, the state of South Carolina, and the Attorney General of Michigan on behalf of the people of Michigan. Greg and I don't represent the state plaintiffs. We're working with them, but they represent themselves. But let me walk through briefly what the new claims are about and why they've been brought. You might recall, with respect to our challenge to the CFPB and the FSOC, our basic claim was that these laws violate the separation of powers. They create independent agencies that enjoy unprecedented insulation against oversight by the other branches of government, and that is coupled with an effectively unbounded delegation of power to the agencies. Any one of the features we complain about in the case, taken in isolation, might itself be held constitutional by the courts. For example, the CFPB director enjoys some form of tenure protection against the president's power to remove him from office. Obviously, that's been affirmed before in cases such as Morrison v. Olson, the independent counsel case, and years ago in Humphrey's Executor, the original independent agency case brought during the New Deal. Similarly, the courts have regularly affirmed broad grants of power by Congress to agencies. But in our case, our specific argument is that the combination of multiple forms of independence and that broad grant of power add up to an unprecedented situation that violates the separation of powers. Now, our first claim against the Orderly Liquidation Authority is basically that same theory. The Orderly Liquidation Authority, it's not funded by Congress, therefore Congress doesn't have any sort of power of the purse over the agency. It's basically insulated against any meaningful judicial review, and I'll get into that in a second. And third, the standards that are applied by the regulators in deciding whether to liquidate a financial company and how to go about liquidating it are completely open-ended. The judicial review provisions of orderly liquidation tend to capture the most headlines, and probably rightfully so. It's truly draconian. If the Treasury Secretary decides to liquidate a financial company based on the recommendations of the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, he informs the company that he wants to liquidate it. If the company objects, the Treasury Secretary goes to Federal District Court in Washington and asks the court to approve his decision's determination to liquidate the company. The District Court has 24 hours to review the Treasury Secretary's findings. That's literally 24 hours. The court has to come to a final decision on the merits of the case within 24 hours, or the government wins by default, and it can begin taking apart the company. That first round of judicial review is subject to strict gag orders. Other stakeholders won't even know that this liquidation is happening until the case is decided. Now, once the Treasury Secretary gets past the district court level, he can begin liquidating the company. The Court of Appeals can hear an expedited appeal of the case, but it can't stay the liquidation. During the liquidation, the FDIC is specifically authorized by Dodd-Frank to disregard the ordinary laws of bankruptcy with respect to creditors. You know, normally under bankruptcy, similarly situated creditors need to be treated on par with one another. Well, in this case, in this statutory framework, that's explicitly overridden, and the FDIC can pick and choose creditors at will. That is why the states come in. As we explained in the amended complaint, the states are creditors in large financial companies. They own the debt of large financial companies. And so on the face of Dodd-Frank, their rights as creditors are abrogated. Now, in addition to the separation of powers claim, there are two other claims against orderly liquidation. One, that the provisions that I just described violate due process, the deprivation of property without due process of law. And second, or third, I guess, is the claim that these provisions, by giving completely untrammeled discretion to regulators, violates the Constitution's requirement that the nation's bankruptcy laws be, quote, uniform. Again, those three claims are brought primarily by the states. The other parties, the private parties in the case, also join those claims. And so those claims and those parties were added to the case in September. The government filed its motion to dismiss all the claims in November, and our deadline for the private and state plaintiffs to respond is at the end of January. And so now I'll turn it over to Greg to describe that state of the case.
Certainly. Thanks, Adam. As Adam has mentioned, the government's response to the amended complaint was filed at the end of November, and they responded to the amended complaint by filing a motion to dismiss, alleging that none of the plaintiffs to the lawsuit properly have standing to challenge the three titles of the Dodd-Frank Act that are at issue. So I'm going to briefly describe the nature of the government's motion to dismiss as applied to Adams and my clients, the State National Bank of Big Spring, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and the 60 Plus Association, and then turn it back over to Adam to describe their arguments that the states don't have standing to pursue their challenges to Title II, the Orderly Liquidation Authority. The private plaintiffs, as we had discussed in greater detail in our previous call about this back in September, challenged two titles of the Dodd-Frank Act, Title 10, which creates the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Title 1, which creates the Financial Stability Oversight Council. So I'll go over each of the sets of dismissal arguments there in turn. With respect to the CFPB, the first argument that the government makes as to why, in our view, we don't have standing to challenge the CFPB is that the bank that we represent, State National Bank of Big Spring, isn't directly subject to the CFPB's regulatory authority. And what they mean by that is that the Dodd-Frank Act, when it was created, established a monetary capitalization threshold. And banks that have smaller capitalization than the designated amount are subject to the authority of prudential regulators. In our case, the State National Bank of Big Spring is directly subject to the regulatory control of the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. However, even though the OCC is our prudential regulator and under the terms of the Dodd-Frank Act has primary enforcement authority, the government concedes in its brief that we are subject to, for example, the CFPB requiring us to file reports. We also are, of course, subject to any regulations that the CFPB may promulgate, including ones that it has already promulgated. And we allege in our complaint that the CFPB has a variety of ways to control and manipulate the regulatory authority as it is exercised of those prudential regulators. They're allowed to have examiners that sit in during examinations. They're allowed to call up the prudential regulators or write to them and require them to look into alleged violations of consumer financial laws, et cetera. And under the terms of our complaint, which at a motion to dismiss stage have to be taken to be true as long as plausible, we allege that this gives the CFPB substantial control over our regulation by the OCC, in addition to its ability to directly require us to file reports and, of course, to follow actual regulations that they issue. The second argument that the government makes, I'll break down into two parts, which is essentially that we have not sustained an actionable injury of any kind that's attributable to the CFPB. And our complaint had alleged two basic injuries. The first being that the bank exited the mortgage market in response to the CFPB's authority to prosecute unfair, deceptive, and abusive lending practices, which are not defined in the Dodd-Frank Act. And although at least with respect to the terms unfair and deceptive, there is some precedent from other consumer agencies, the term abusive is nowhere defined in law. It's really unclear what abusive could mean if what you're talking about, since it's an additional phrase beyond unfair and deceptive, what is a practice that is not unfair and not deceptive and yet is abusive to consumers? And in fact, in addressing that question, as the complaint makes clear, the CFPB director, Richard Cordray, has telegraphed that they're not entirely sure what it means and that they intend to work it out through ad hoc litigation on a case-by-case basis. Our complaint alleges that because of our inability to predict how the CFPB will exercise that authority, we had to exit the mortgage market because it was the only way to be sure that we wouldn't suffer an ex post facto enforcement action by the board as part or by the CFPB rather as part of its campaign to work out what abusive means. The government alleges, well, that's not a sufficient injury for two reasons. One, we haven't enforced against your bank yet. There's no reason why you should believe that we would. And they say, therefore, you know, although your exit from the mortgage market may have hurt your financial bottom line, it's a self-inflicted injury. You didn't have to do that. And essentially, their point of view is that we should have just stayed in the mortgage market, waited for them to come and enforce against us, incur all the expenses at that time of having to deal with that, and that that would have been the only way to challenge them. The other injury that was alleged in our complaint that's directly attributable to the CFPB was the promulgation of a rule that governs the conditions under which international wire transfers or remittances can be made. And the complaint states that the bank effectively, because of the massive amount of information that's required to be provided to consumers who are requesting wire transfers, simply isn't able to cost-effectively provide that service anymore. A Citibank or a Wells Fargo might be able to have international branches and know exactly what the exchange rate is going to be at the exact branch in the foreign country to which the transfer is being made. But our small community bank in the state of Texas just doesn't have access to that information, and it would be prohibitively expensive for them to try to get that and to give it to consumers in each instance. And as a result, when the rule was promulgated requiring all these additional disclosures, they were required to stop offering remittances. The first argument the government makes is that we haven't sufficiently alleged that we're actually subject to the remittance rule. The remittance rule, by its own terms, requires that that you engage in remittances as a during your regular course of business. They allege that the complaint doesn't sufficiently allege that we did it as a regular course of business. I think that that argument is relatively frivolous given the nature of the transactions that we allege in the complaint. But they then allege that the remittance rule isn't promulgated pursuant to the powers of the CFPB that we have challenged as a matter of constitutional separation of powers jurisprudence. Now, the complaint alleges, and this harkens back to our previous call, and this gets into the merits, but we essentially allege that the CFPB combines a number of different features of lack of the of controls mandated by the Constitution, required as a matter of the separation of powers. Congress has given up its power of purse control over the CFPB by not making it subject to regular budgetary appropriations. Rather, the CFPB simply designates a portion of the Federal Reserve's budget each year that it automatically gets without any oversight at all from Congress, that it has removed the president's control by prohibiting the president from removing the director of the CFPB for policy reasons. It alleges that it has no internal checks and controls, typical for other federal administrative boards like the NLRB or the FEC, because all of the power of the Bureau is consolidated in a single director instead of diffusing it among a number of commissioners who are of different political parties and therefore provide some accountability to one another. And finally, it alleges that the aforementioned unfair, deceptive, and abusive authority is so broad that in combination with the lack of the checks and controls that I just mentioned, that this constitutes a separation of powers violation. Now, what the government comes in and says, well, the remittance rule authority of the CFPB, their authority to establish that control is separate and from and different than the authority to prosecute unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices. And we think that your complaint only challenges the authority to prosecute unfair, deceptive, and abusive lending practices. And therefore, even if you were injured by this remittance rule, that's not good enough because your constitutional complaints have nothing to do with that. I don't think that that's at all a fair reading of our complaint. It's clear that the power, lack of power of purse controls, that the lack of presidential removal authority, that the lack of internal checks, governance issues, because all of the power is consolidated in a single director. All of those are true of every single action that the CFPB takes. It is not confined to the its exercise of its unfair, deceptive, and abusive lending practices authority. And furthermore, the complaint clearly alleges that the remittance rule transfer authorities, Electronic Funds Act, authorities are broadly phrased and are part of the suite of authorities that the CFPB has discretion as to how they will go about enforcing. But that effectively is the government's argument with respect to the CFPB. With respect to our challenge to Title I of the Dodd-Frank Act, or the Financial Stability Oversight Council, I need to revert back to the merits briefly here. The basic allegation as to how we are injured by the Financial Stability Oversight Council is that what the FSOC does is it designates non-bank financial institutions as being systemically important. So the Dodd-Frank Act sets a $50 billion threshold and essentially says if you're a bank holding company with $50 billion or more of assets, you're automatically a SIFI, or a systemically important financial institution. But then it creates the FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, to designate additional non-bank financial institutions as being systemically important. And the complaint alleges that a SIFI designation gives an entity that has been designated an advantage in raising capital in the capital markets because it's a signal from the government that this institution is deemed by the government to be too big to fail, which gives creditors or potential creditors of those institutions the comfort of knowing that if that institution gets into trouble, that the government will come in and bail it out rather than let it fail. In other words, it makes it a safer investment. The complaint alleges that that is prejudicial to our client, the bank, which is out there trying to raise capital as well, and will likely be regarded as a less safe investment than some of a SIFI designated institution, because the government's promised to bail those out essentially, but hasn't designated the bank as one that is likely to be backed by the government in the event that it gets into trouble. So the government responds saying, well, that's not a sufficient injury for you to challenge the FSOC. First of all, the FSOC has not yet designated any SIFIs, so there hasn't actually been any harm to you yet. Now, that is in fact true as of this point in time. The government had announced that it was planning to designate SIFIs by the end of 2012. It failed to do that. However, it has said that it is imminent. We know that the work of SIFI designation is ongoing, and we expect that that harm, by the government's own statements, will happen at any time. The second argument that the government makes is, well, you, State National Bank of Big Spring, are a bank, and these institutions that are being designated by the FSOC are non-bank financial institutions. And I'm not saying that these will necessarily be designated, but GE Capital, for example, is one institution, non-bank financial institution, that has been that it has been speculated in some press articles might be named. And they say, well, you just don't compete with them. They don't offer banking services. That is a fundamental misunderstanding, I believe, of the harm that is alleged in the complaint. The complaint doesn't argue that we are in direct competition with these non-bank financial institutions in terms of the services that we provide. It argues that we are in direct competition with them for raising capital, which then allows us to provide services. And if, for example, GE Capital makes auto loans and we make auto loans as a bank as well, which is true, if the non-bank financial institution that's been designated as a SIFI can raise capital more cheaply than we can, then it can undercut us in the making of auto loans because they can offer them more cheaply. So clearly we are in competition with non-bank financial institutions in raising capital, and I think that the government simply fails to understand the nature of the allegation that we've made in the complaint. And finally, the government argues, well, you say that SIFIs are going to get this capital raising advantage in the markets. That's entirely speculative, and we don't think that you have sufficiently alleged that that will actually happen. In fact, the complaint cites to some studies that have shown an advantage that previously designated SIFIs prior to the enactment of Dodd-Frank have enjoyed in capital markets, and we believe that we have sufficiently alleged harm in that regard. Now, I mostly talked about the bank there. The complaint also alleges harm to our other two private plaintiff clients here, the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the 60 Plus Association. The harms that they have suffered are largely because of their role as consumers of financial services, and they've been harmed by the increased costs and the decreased availability of services and the mixture of those two things that are attributable to the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act, and particularly to the operation of the CFPB and eventual operation of the FSOC once it begins to designate SIFIs. So that's the basic nature of the government's arguments that our clients on the private plaintiff side don't have standing. I'll turn it over to Adam to describe the nature of the government's arguments that the states don't have standing to raise their challenge to Title II.
Thanks, Greg. Again, since we don't represent the states, I'm going to be very limited in what I can offer in terms of the state's response to the government's arguments. But in brief, let me give you this. The government basically argues that until the government actually liquidates a financial company that a state invests in, the state doesn't have standing to challenge that part of Dodd-Frank, or either the state lacks standing or that the claims aren't ripe. Basically, they argue that the states won't suffer any actual injury until a liquidation occurs. The state's investments are basically, the state suffers haircuts, so to speak, in their investment in the bank's debt. And furthermore, that the injury that we allege won't occur until the states are treated differently from other similarly situated creditors. Now, that argument basically misunderstands or mischaracterizes the allegations in the complaint. The states didn't allege harm based on future liquidations. They alleged a here-and-now injury based on the fact that Dodd-Frank, on its face, abrogates their rights as creditors. As the famous standing case of Lujan says, an injury occurs when a plaintiff suffers an invasion to a legally protected interest. And the state's interest as creditors to be treated on par with similarly situated creditors and in accordance with the pre-existing bankruptcy laws, that's a legally protected interest that Dodd-Frank violates on the face of the law. Interestingly, the government says in a footnote that even if the states were to suffer an injury in liquidation, they still couldn't bring this case because the Dodd-Frank sets forth a comprehensive administrative scheme, they say, for the FDIC's resolution of creditors' claims. Namely that the states would have to bring their claims to the FDIC as part of the liquidation process and then press their constitutional claims in judicial review of the FDIC's decisions. What's interesting about that argument is it's actually not true. Dodd-Frank's Title II, the Orderly Liquidation Authority provision, it very much narrows the issues the courts can hear in the liquidation process. I already talked about how short the periods for review are. But on top of that, Dodd-Frank limits the issues the courts can hear. And to cut to the chase, at no point in a review of either the Treasury Secretary's liquidation decision or the FDIC's actions in carrying out the liquidation could these constitutional claims actually be brought on appeal. And so the question, it's not a choice between bringing these claims before liquidation and bringing them after liquidation. It's a choice between bringing these claims before liquidation and not being able to bring them at all. And so again, on the government's major error in their argument is to characterize the injuries the states face as future injuries that haven't occurred yet. The injuries already have occurred. They've occurred on the face of the law, and they are abrogations of the state's rights as creditors. And so that, we expect, will be the main argument in response to the government's motion. And with that, Dean, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, you should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So stand by for that. So once again, if you have a question for either Greg Jacobs or Adam White, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have just one question, after which our lines will be open. So again, star button and then the pound button if you have a question. Before we go to the first question, let me make a regular routine programming announcement. Later this week on Thursday at 1 p.m., we're going to host another Teleforum conference call. This one will be with Mr. John Allison. He's the new head of Cato and the former head of BB&T Bank. Mr. Allison is also the author of the recently released book, The Financial Crisis and the Free Market Cure, Why Pure Capitalism is the World Economy's Only Hope. And he'll be discussing his book and other matters on our Teleforum on Thursday. Again, that's at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Now we have four questions, so let's go to the first caller.
Hi, this is Jim Rocket from San Francisco. When I attended the Federalist Society convention in November, Boyden Gray made a comment about some threats that had been made against the bank by the OCC following the commencement of this suit. Is there any follow-up on that? Has the OCC continued to make any threats against the bank as a result of its commencing this suit?
This is Adam. Let me take that since I work with Boyden. You're right. Boyden made some reference to the contact that was made between OCC and the bank shortly after the complaint. I really, beyond going into what Boyden's already said in public, we're really not in a position to say anything more about what's happened behind the scenes with the client.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I can't offer more.
All right, let's go to the next caller. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Greg, I have just a comment as opposed to a question. When you mentioned the remittance transfer rule and the difficulty of disclosing exchange rates for 200 countries around the world and it possibly being achievable by large banks but not by small banks, I understand the remittance rule actually also requires the wire transfer firm to compute up the foreign government tax that would be imposed on the transfer so that it could disclose what the ultimate amount would be received, which would require every bank in the United States to know the tax laws of every country in the world. And I am told from a conference call that that is not only a very difficult challenge to small banks, but that's a very difficult challenge to even large banks. And they're not sure how they're going to be able to comply with something like that and monitor changes in the tax laws in 200 countries around the world.
Well, thank you for that comment. And I think that it is clear that the changes that were required under the terms of the Dodd-Frank Act to be made to the rules governing these remittance transfers were not particularly well thought through either by the folks in Congress who were putting requirements that the rules be changed into place or by the folks at the CFPB mm-hmm. who decided what the final terms of the rule would be. And indeed, our client, State National Bank of Big Spring, Jim Purcell, testified before Congress in part about the burdens that have resulted from that rule, among other things. And it was clear that from both sides of the aisle, in terms of congressmen who were asking questions, that they understood that there were real problems with the way that this was being implemented that simply had not been thought through adequately. And indeed, shortly after that testimony, the CFPB responded to at least some of those criticisms by putting in a 100 transfer threshold that basically mm-hmm. says if you do fewer than 100 transfers a year, then you're not subject to the rule, in the hopes of trying to assuage some of the groundswell of opposition to it. But even since putting that in, as you noted, larger banks that do 100 or more a year, and actually not even just larger banks. I mean, our client does a substantial number a year as well. But they face so many regulatory hurdles and have to provide so much information that's difficult to access that it's not surprising to me, given some of the institutions that have already indicated that they also are going to have to get out of the business of doing these remittance transfers because of the increased cost. Large institutions have made that announcement, and it's clear. I mean, the CFPB has on a couple of occasions now announced intentions to refine various aspects of the rule just in order to try to stem the tide of institutions saying, hey, we can't do this. We're going to have to get out of doing this mm-hmm. as well. So I think it's quite clear that the CFPB is in the process of backpedaling right now and trying to come up with something that makes more sense than what they have put out there. But there are real problems for all kinds of financial institutions. But I think the smaller that you are, and particularly our community banks, it's so prohibitively expensive for them. If it's going to be hard for the larger financial institutions, it's just going to be absolutely cost prohibitive for the smaller ones.
I agree. Thank you.
That was Greg Jacob. Adam White, do you have anything to add on this point?
No, not on top of that. That was good.
Jerry Lozier, were you going to say something further?
No, just thank you very much, Greg. It really is a terrible burden.
Okay, thanks. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two more questions at this point, and then the lines will be open.
Hi, this is Tom Quadman. I just have a quick point of information I just want to pass on that may or may not be helpful. I think your characterization about the designations of non-bank financials is correct. There's just one point additionally I just wanted to add to that, and that is that for the Fed to move for FSOC to move forward in terms of designating non-bank financials, is actually embedded in Dodd-Frank, and this was put in by Senators Vitter and Pryor, a specific test for whether or not non-bank financial companies can even be considered for designation, and that defines specific criteria that's embedded in regulation, I think it's K, and that the regulators cannot go beyond that that test. However, the Federal Reserve proposed a rule, which they still have not finalized, it purports to go beyond that. So effectively what you have is you have FSOC trying to designate non-bank financials without even finalizing what the tests are for what the pool is for what non-bank financial companies even are. So it's that they're going even beyond where they should be going at this point in time. So I just wanted to pass that on to you.
Thank you. This is Greg Jacob. That's very helpful. And one thing I'll note in that regard is that there are some criteria that are established by the Dodd-Frank Act that are supposed to be considered by the FSOC in designating non-bank financial institutions. The last of those criteria, and as you note, there are issues with respect to the definition of what a non-bank financial institution even is. But then in terms of the designation criteria, there's a final criteria that essentially says, go ahead and consider anything else that you think may be relevant for purposes of making such a designation. And so it's a very open-ended authority that provides a little bit of guidance, but then opens the door completely for any kind of factor to be considered
But that's on stage two. What I was talking about is on the predominantly engaged test, which is
right.
Stage two. One.
Yeah, exactly.
They haven't even completed the rulemaking yet on stage one.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think just shows how ramshackle this whole process is on all of these open-ended criteria that lack adequate definition and where the regulatory agencies that are out there, as you know, in this case, the Federal Reserve, aren't even necessarily hewing closely to what's provided for in the statute.
You know, if I could add on top of that, just to sort of take a step back from all of this, as we explained at the outset of the call, I mean, one of the problems here is it's not just that the regulators get these open-ended standards. It's the combination of that with the lack of checks and balances to guide their exercise of that judgment. You know, the old cases, the non-delegation doctrine cases, they all were in the Supreme Court. They were all litigated against the backdrop or the background assumption that when the regulators use these broad grants of power that the court ultimately affirmed, it would be, you know, against at the very least judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act and so forth to review what the agencies had done. They would, as we've seen in cases like State Farm and Chevron, and the baseline assumption that these agencies are operating under the guidance of politically accountable officials and Congress. And scholars like Tom Merrill and others have done a great job of connecting the non-delegation doctrine to the background presumptions of judicial review. Well, in this case, to take, for example, the FSOC issue we just discussed, you know, there's the broad delegation of power, and the exact language is the FSOC, the last consideration for the FSOC to take into consideration in designating non-bank financial companies as systemically important is, quote, any other risk-related factors that the council deems appropriate. I mean, it's so open-ended as to be effectively meaningless, a blank check. And it's bad enough that the regulators get the blank check, but it's even worse that they then get to cash that check without, so to speak, obtaining the signatures of at least the other branches of government.
All right, we have one final question at this point. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines will be open.
This is Bert Ely calling. Again, thank you for this this excellent update. On December 26th, the Seventh Circuit issued an opinion in Richards v. NLRB that had as part of the case a challenge to the legitimacy of the NLRB recess appointments. As I understand it from the article I've read about this case, that the court did not need to reach the legitimacy of the NLRB recess appointments. That aside, was there any aspect of that court's decision that has any impact in one way or another on the State National Bank of Big Spring case? And then a related question is, I understand that the D.C. Circuit heard oral arguments in the Noel Cumming v. NLRB case, which is also, as I understand it, challenging the NLRB appointment. Was there anything in those briefs or in the oral argument that would have a bearing on the case we've been talking about today?
Greg, do you want to take that or should I?
No, Adam was actually at the argument in the Noel Cannon case, so I think that he'd be the ideal person to handle this one.
Sure. Well, let me start with the D.C. Circuit case, the Noel Cannon case. Like Greg said, I was there. I mean, simply put, the case is argued in the D.C. Circuit. We have filed our case in the district court in Washington, and so it's quite possible the D.C. Circuit will make a decision on those NLRB recess appointments before our case is decided, and that the court's ruling in that case could control our case. I mean, the recess appointments for the NLRB were made in basically the same way that the CFPB recess appointment that we're challenging was made. Basically, the same circumstances and so forth. And so the cases are very closely aligned. Now, it's not necessarily true that the D.C. Circuit's decision will control our case. I mean, for example, the D.C. Circuit might dismiss. I'm not making a prediction. I mean, this is just sheer speculation. I mean, the court could dismiss or decide the case on grounds not squarely at issue in our case, perhaps jurisdictional grounds or something that could result in the NLRB case being dismissed, but our case still remaining viable. I mean, it's impossible to say for certain, but I mean, it is fair to say that the two cases are very, very similar. And so the D.C. Circuit's decision could have a very direct bearing on our case. Now, with respect to the Seventh Circuit case, which I was less familiar with, I know the court dismissed it. If I recall correctly, they dismissed it because I guess the petitioners had lacked injury. I think perhaps the NLRB had later issued final orders that had actually repaired the injuries that the petitioners had originally complained of. I can't quite recall. It was the day after Christmas, and so, like a lot of people, I'm still catching up. But in any event, I mean, the case that's most directly relevant to our case, it's not the Seventh Circuit case. It's the D.C. Circuit's NLRB cases.
Greg Jacobs, anything to add there?
No, I think that covers it.
Okay. I should make a note that earlier today, we're in the process of organizing a teleform conference call, likely on the Noel Canning case, through our labor and employment law practice group. So look for the scheduling of that on our website. Looks like we have another question. Again, we just have one question on the board now. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button. Let's go to what for now looks to be our final question.
Hi, this is Hester Peirce from the Mercatus Center. I was just wondering if you looked at the recent GAO report on Dodd-Frank rulemakings and the effect on SIFI's ability on SIFI's ability to fund themselves.
This is Greg Jacob. The GAO was commissioned to do that report by Congress. We have. Obviously, the commissioning of that report occurred subsequent to the filing of the complaint, and so it isn't in any way referenced therein. And our potential ability to – it's possible that we could make use of that in our response to the government's motion to dismiss with respect to the FSOC issues. So I guess the short answer is yes, we're aware of the report, and but that it has not yet been referenced in the course of the litigation because it hadn't been.
It just
been.
Came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just this is Adam. Just to reiterate something that Greg said earlier, well, we'll all look with great interest on what the GAO report says. There's already a deep body of academic literature, even before Dodd-Frank's passage enactment, identifying the very direct cost of capital subsidies that banks seen as too big to fail already received before Dodd-Frank. And Dodd-Frank sort of exacerbates that effect in three ways. It lowered the threshold for what it took to be considered a SIFI. I mean, SIFIs usually, a bank was usually assumed to be a SIFI if it had $100 billion in assets. Well, Dodd-Frank brings that down to $50 billion. Second, it expands from SIFI status from not just banks to now non-bank financial companies that were never thought of as being SIFIs. And third, it takes SIFI status from being sort of an implicit possible background subsidy and makes it a very concrete designation. And so it doesn't take, you know, great economic leaps of logic to see how Dodd-Frank just takes the pre-existing subsidy and exacerbates it. And I'm hopeful that the GAO confirms what the Bank of England and other studies have already determined.
Greg, Jacob, anything further on this?
No.
Okay. Looks like we've got another question. Let's go to our next caller. Again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. The Dodd-Frank bill seems to lack a coherent theory, constitutional theory, for some of its provisions. The only authority one can find in the Constitution for liquidating institutions is a bankruptcy clause, and bankruptcy contemplates organizations that have become insolvent. It does leave it to Congress to define what constitutes insolvency, and in principle, it could define it as threatening to become insolvent at a time in the future when it would be dangerous to the public for that to happen. But without an argument that ties back to the bankruptcy clause and that sets forth the idea of proactive bankruptcy, it seems to be a constitutionally infirm. What is your comment on that?
This is Greg Jacob. As Adam noted, our amended complaint, which includes the challenges by the states, and again, I'll reiterate, Adam and I don't represent the states here. They represent themselves and the challenges. But as described in the first amended complaint, there is a challenge raised to the orderly liquidation authority on the grounds that this must be indeed, as you note, an exercise of the bankruptcy power, and that the bankruptcy power is required to be exercised in a way that is uniform. That is one of the two places, I believe, in the Constitution that the term uniform appears. There is a Supreme Court case from, I believe, the 1870s that actually applies that terminology in a railroad case and finds that congressional action trying to utilize that power with respect to a single railroad and for the benefit of a single railroad was not, in fact, uniform and therefore invalidating that application of Congress's power. Now, in terms of whether because the orderly liquidation authority can be invoked with respect to an institution that is deemed by the Treasury Secretary to be in danger of insolvency as opposed to one that is actually insolvent, whether that would render the exercise of the underlying authorities infirm under the Constitution is not raised by the complaint. I think probably in large part because the states and their challenges are raising the challenges not as institutions that would themselves be directly subject to a liquidation. So it wouldn't be, hey, you might be moving to liquidate us at a time when we're not actually insolvent. Rather, they are creditors of those institutions who would be and are impacted by the rules that abrogate the protections that they previously enjoyed under the previously existing bankruptcy rules, which required uniform treatment of similarly situated creditors. Those rules are abrogated by the Dodd-Frank Act, and so that is the aspect of the power that has been challenged by the states. But I think you raise a very interesting point that could be raised by a financial institution against that was preceded against by the Orderly Liquidation Authority at some point in time, and could argue that the entirety of the power conferred can only have been exercised by Congress under the bankruptcy power. In other words, that it's not a proper exercise of the Interstate Commerce Clause power, and that under the bankruptcy power, it wouldn't be appropriate to reach an institution that was not actually insolvent. I think it would be a very interesting theory for them to raise at that point.
Adam White, do you want to weigh in here?
I've got nothing to add to that.
Okay. Looks like we've exhausted all the questions from our audience members. Let me turn to each of you and see if you have a final thought you want to express before we move on. Greg, you want to
go first? Well, this is Greg. I'll just offer one quick additional factual point that I think we hadn't necessarily made before, which is simply that our response to the government's motion to dismiss is due at the end of this month on January 30th. And so we've tried to be circumspect on this call and not telegraphing the strategy of what exactly will be in that response. But for those that are interested, of course, it's a publicly filed document, and I expect will be probably posted on CEI's website shortly after it's filed as well.
Adam White, if you have anything.
I couldn't improve on that. I'll let that be the last word.
Terrific. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, gentlemen, let me thank both Greg Jacob and Adam White for joining us today. We look forward to having you back perhaps at a future time as this case continues to move along. For our audience, again, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call on Thursday when we'll be welcoming John Allison. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.